Horth, Mother Allen. He will lead us in today's message.
Greetings, one and all. Welcome to Sabbath services on this beautiful October. I think this has got to be my favorite month. Beautiful. You probably think of yourself as an individual, but you're actually a collection of trillions of cells. Living cells, complex cells, each with a specific job to do, and all working in harmony. In fact, our very lives depend on the fact that all the cells in our body work together and do their job. All trillions of cells working together. And everything works splendidly so long as the cells know their place and work in harmony. There are cells, however, that don't work for the team. In fact, they hurt the team. We call them cancer cells. They divide uncontrollably, splitting wildly into new cells faster than the normal cells do, and they don't stop dividing regardless of the damage that they cause. They simply ignore the biological commands that tell your cells when to stop and how to behave. Eventually, this unchecked cell growth can lead to a tumor, a semi-autonomous mass of tissue that serves no particular purpose at all. No productive purpose, and it just keeps growing and growing. Through its own growth, it can damage surrounding cells. Worse still, unlike normal cells, a cancer cell can detach and go to some other part of the body and start again doing the same thing, causing more damage someplace else. The worse the cancer gets, the more the cancer cells tend to take an undifferentiated, immature form. Your body contains more than 200 different types of cells, each with a specific job that it does. I mean, you've got bone cells, you've got skin cells, you've got nerve cells, all of these cells doing a job. Cancer cells, however, are both incapable of doing a useful job and are increasingly aggressive. Cancer cells get this way because they're broken. Your cells work by following specific instructions. And it's just amazing. You know, how could a cell without a brain know that its work involves a harmonious function within a body of other trillions of cells working together? It speaks to a creator. These instructions are found in each of the cell's nucleuses laid out in sequences of DNA called genes. Each of your genes, and there are tens of thousands of them, contain a code that tells the cell how to do its job. At least two of these gene types, proto-oncogene and tumor suppressor genes, can cause serious trouble if they get messed up or mutate. Proto-oncogenes regulate when, how, and how much your cells divide. Tumor suppressor genes help keep this process in line and can put the brakes on cellular reproduction if necessary. They're also the genes that tell your cells how to fix damaged genes. So Yahweh placed within your body an ability to repair itself. With a mutation or two, proto-oncogenes can turn into oncogenes, basically genes that cause cancer, from good to bad. The affected cell becomes hyperactive and divides free of the usual constraints. Your tumor suppressor genes can slam on the brakes, repair the DNA, and even call for the ultimate sacrifice, apoptosis, or cell suicide. When a cell's DNA sustains so much damage that it's beyond repair, a healthy cell, still thinking as part of the team, will destroy itself to prevent greater problems. Cancer tends to strike older people because it takes many multi-mutations to bring on a cancer cell. And those mutations can take a long time to occur. That's why usually cancer affects older people. But sometimes you're born with these mutations. And it's so sad to see a 10-year-old child with leukemia. But That's what happened in its genetic makeup. He's got a defect, a broken gene. There are almost as many ways in which genes can go bad as there are genes involved in cancer. You got molecular mutations that can change the DNA sequence, scrambling the code and turning healthy genes into oncogenes. Or there could be errors in cell division itself that cause entire genes to move to a new location, get repeated, or be deleted altogether. Sometimes these mutations are hereditary. Other times they happen over a lifetime. They could happen at random, or they could be caused by environmental problems and effects like carcinogens, cigarette smoke, or ultraviolet radiation and sunlight affecting your skin cells and causing cancerous growth there. Even viruses can cause cancer, and I was surprised to learn that. Viruses, of course, get into the cell itself and change the DNA so it starts producing more virus cells. Well, that's kind of what cancer does. In fact, part of what makes cancer so tough to cure is that it isn't a single disease with a single cause. The word cancer actually refers to 100 distinct diseases, all characterized by out-of-control cell growth. Because the diseases are different, treatments that are effective for one may not be effective for another type of cancer. Well, as I was reading this and studying about this, I couldn't help apply cancer's behavior in a spiritual way. A parallel can be made between cancer's characteristics and an anomaly in the assembly. Like healthy cells, when all the members work together in harmony, the assembly grows and prospers and does real well. When each member knows his place and pulls for the greater good of the body, then the body is healthy. But when a radical interest arises or infiltrates, who has no real love or regard for the body as a whole, and shows little concern about maintaining the bond of unity, and who operates totally out of self-interest while seeking to further his own selfish aims, that assembly has contracted cancer. Left unchecked, the body will die. After many decades in the truth of Yahweh, I've seen renegades come into the body with characteristically selfish motives to draw some away, like a cancer. Because they can't seem to make a go of it on their own, these parasites feed off of other assemblies, just like an invading cancer cell does. Well, today I'd like to arm you with the knowledge of the motives and tactics of these insurgents, these spiritual insurgents, so that you can be better equipped not only to recognize it, but also to counter it and resist it. And we know that it will come. It's inevitable that this will come. We've not seen the last of cancerous invasions by any means. Paul never found relief from such attacks, and we can't expect anything different. He warns over in Acts chapter 20 about wolves entering the flock. Acts chapter 20 and verse 28. It says there something very important. Take heed, therefore, unto yourselves and to all the flock over which the Holy Spirit made you an overseer to feed the assembly of Yahweh, which he has purchased with his own blood. For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. Also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them. Therefore watch and remember that by the space of 3 years I ceased not to warn everyone night and day with tears. Paul was very concerned about it. He was concerned about what could happen when an assembly gets cancer. Yahshua indicates over Matthew 24 that in this time of the end, deceptions would multiply. And there'd be more and more of this type of thing. People being confused and not knowing what is right and what is wrong. He says, and many false prophets shall arise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. In fact, this is such a big problem that Yahshua predicted that the entire time between his two comings would be characterized and filled with a steady stream of false prophets and teachers. The first century assembly, as we know, had an immediate outbreak of this kind of teacher. And eventually, every New Testament letter warns about bogus teachers and wannabe leaders. Peter warned about it, so did John, so did Jude. 2 Peter 2, 1-10, I want to read this out of the NIV because I think it's a little easier to grasp, to get hold of what's being said here. 2 Peter 2, 1, but there were also false prophets among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you. They will secretly introduce destructive heresies. Secretly introduce. They hit you blindside. You're not ready for it. Even denying the sovereign master who bought them, bringing swift destruction on themselves. Many will follow their shameful ways, it says in verse 2, and will bring the way of truth into disrepute. In their greed, these teachers will exploit you with stories they've made up. Their condemnation has long been hanging over them, and their destruction has not been sleeping. For if Elohim did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to Gehenna, putting them into gloomy dungeons to be held for judgment. If he did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood on its unrighteous people, but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and seven others. If he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by burning them to ashes and made them an example of what's going to happen to the unrighteous. Verse 7, if he rescued Lot, a righteous man, who was distressed by the filthy lives of lawless men, for that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard. We had a little get-together at work, and, you know, the conversation goes from one topic to another until it finally reached sodomites. I just couldn't handle it. I mean, not that they were supporting it, but you know, talking about it just is bad enough. If this is so, then Yahweh knows how to rescue righteous men from trials and to hold the unrighteous for the day of judgment while continuing their punishment. This is especially true, it says, of those who follow the corrupt desire of the sinful nature and despise authority. Well, we know that the first century assembly saw an immediate outbreak of all kinds of insincere and self-teachers, selfish teachers. Virtually every New Testament letter warns against it. John, over in 1 John 2:18, he says, "Dear children, this is the last hour, and as you have heard that Anti-Messiah is coming, even now many Anti-Messiahs have come, this is how we know it is the last hour." Verse 19, "They went out from us, but they did not really belong to us. If they had belonged to us, they would have remained with us, but their going showed that none of them belonged to us." John further wrote, 1 John 2:26, "I am writing these things to you about those who are trying to lead you astray." Jude chimes in verse 4, he says, "For certain men whose condemnation was written about long ago have secretly slipped in among you. They are wicked men who change the grace of our Elohim into license for immorality and deny Yahshua, our only sovereign and master." 1 John tells us that anyone who denies Yahshua is considered anti-Messiah. Anyone. At this very moment, brethren, an assembly not far away is struggling with spiritual invasion. Deceivers came in, took root, and split the body apart. I talked to a brother at the Feast of Tabernacles this year who mentioned that he's familiar with this situation and the group he came from. The group eventually expired, belly up, from the problem caused by a cancerous growth. You know, if you look at it, there are really two kinds of wolves that enter in and become accepted and over time begin their dirty work. Two kinds. The one that works that way internally, and then those that come from the outside who briefly infiltrate, grab a following, then they're gone, never be heard from again. Most of these hit-and-run wolves operate on the fringes, avoiding confrontation with the leadership in their pursuit of the sheep. To validate themselves, they try to legitimize their scheme. The connivers focus on what I call hobby horse doctrines. They've worked on this doctrine over time and got it down pat. And they've got it so well, and they've answered all the objections that they convince people that they're right. And they could be wild fanatic doctrines, anything weird. But these deviations, these doctrinal deviations, act like a rogue cancer, spawned by twisting scripture, or they grow out of elaborately conceived arguments. And like cancer cells, they're used on anyone who'll give them the time and the attention. Teaching a different biblical calendar is a popular scheme for drawing some away. Often it involves an anomaly about the observance of a day, maybe a different way to keep it. Whatever makes them stand out, gets them noticed, this is what they're after. And they'll use it to their utmost advantage. The less effective of these insurgents will go to some extreme. They'll say, oh, well, I don't believe in Satan. Or they'll deny the inspiration of Paul or the New Testament. Well, their camouflage is very, you know, that's pretty obvious, and it's pretty clear what they're up to. Whatever the motive, doctrinal departures are the drawing card and the rallying point, just like Satan tempting Eve. Oh, you don't really believe that, do you? They'll put doubts in people's minds about what they've been taught and what they believe. Now, I'm not saying that everyone with a doctrinal difference has motives like this. Obviously not. People just look at the Bible differently and maybe haven't come to a right understanding, perhaps. Some are simply deceived and they just don't know it. I'm only saying that whenever you see doctrinal differences aggressively introduced by someone running around through the flock, a warning flag should go up. These are the typical modus operandi of the infiltrators. You know, I have yet in 35 years seen anyone come in, and attempt to draw a following with the promise of a more effective ministry. Someone who says, I'll work harder, I'll work better, I'll work more effectively, and I'll reach more people faster and better. You know, that'd be interesting. I'd be very much interested in that. Show me more. They never do that. You'll never see that because that shows genuine, unselfish motives. That demonstrates love for the brethren, for reaching out, for helping people come to the knowledge of the truth. You won't witness that because the insurgents are basically lazy, or they wouldn't be tearing down already established groups. They'd be out there on the, you know, firing up their own ministries and making a go of it, and this whole problem wouldn't even exist. You see, most who want a ministry really don't want the work of a ministry. Found that true throughout the years. They really don't want the work, and that's work with a capital W. They just want the gravy. They come in when all the work is done and set up camp. You know, I'm here to tell you, it's work to host a Feast of Tabernacles. We all know that, and everybody that was involved in this year's feast know it's work. It takes preparation. It takes, you know, night and day work to get everything ready. And as much as we love it, and as much as, you know, we want to observe Yahweh's days, there's a certain amount of work that goes into it. It's work to prepare weekly messages, to write and produce literature, prepare and send out mail, answer scriptural questions every day, perform all the many other serving duties involved in a ministry. And I admit, I wouldn't have it any other way, because that's what it's all about. But most wannabes don't want that. They don't want most of their free time tied up serving others. They don't want the responsibility of constantly being called on to solve problems with and among the membership. The real ministry is found where the rubber meets the road. I'm convinced that most wannabes really have no clue about what it's all about, or they wouldn't be doing it. You see, a minister is basically a glorified servant. He's just a much busier bondman. In Mark 9, the disciples were vying for supremacy, or at least they wanted to know where they fit. Where do they fit in the grand scheme? And in verse 35, Joshua answers them. Let's look at this. Very interesting little snippet here. Mark 9. Let's look at verse 34. But they held their peace, for by the way they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12 together and says, "Fellas, if any man desire to be first, the same shall be last of all and servant of all." If you want to be first, if you want to be greatest, you've got to be the servant of all. If you think it's all about greatness and glory, be warned that any perceived greatness comes on the back of your own sacrificial serving. That's where it's all about. If you desire the office, Paul told Timothy, that's a good thing. That's wonderful. But you also must know that you're in for the long haul. Hand to the plow, no looking back. Through many difficult times, times so hard that sometimes you might feel like just chucking it all and go fishing like Peter did, remember? The rest of them joined him. After Joshua left, he says, "I can't handle this. I can't do this. We need Joshua back here." It's a work filled with spiritual struggles and hand-to-hand combat. It's not a job for the faint of heart. It's a full-time commitment. And your family is going to be involved as well. Just as much. And that's why we've seen so many wannabes just fizzle out in short order. Like cancer, they do their work of poisoning others, pull them out, and then they themselves dry up because they were not called by Yahweh as they thought they were. And if Yahweh isn't behind an effort, it's not going to survive. Do you remember in Acts chapter 5, where the lawyer named Gamaliel interceded for Peter and the others, when the Sanhedrin wanted to draw and quarter them for preaching the name? Remember that? Acts chapter 5, verse 34. "Then stood there up one in the council, a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a doctor of the law." He was a lawyer, a man who studied the law, knew the law, taught the law, "had in reputation among all the people and commanded to put the apostles forth a little space." So he was some guy who was esteemed in the group of the Sanhedrin. And he says, "Tell you what, come on over here. You guys stay over there." He told the people to come by here. "Let's huddle and I'll tell you something. He said unto them, 'Ye men of Israel, take heed to yourselves what you intend to do as touching these men.'" This man had some perception, this man. "For before these days rose up Theudas, boasting himself to be somebody." He was an insurgent, apparently, "to whom a number of men, about 400, joined themselves, who was slain." Didn't have Yahweh's protection, apparently. "And all, as many as obeyed him, were scattered and brought to nothing." And then, do you remember? "Another man named Judas of Galilee, in the days of the taxing, drew away much people after him. He also perished. And all, even as many as obeyed him, were dispersed. And now I say unto you, refrain from these men, and let them alone. For if this counsel or this work be of men, it will come to nothing." You don't have to worry about it. It'll self-destruct. "But if it be of Elohim, you cannot overthrow it, lest haply or by chance you be found even to fight against Elohim." So they agreed with him. When they called the apostles back, they beat them. They commanded they should not speak in the name of Yahshua, and let them go. What did the apostles do? "Well, that's all we can handle. Let's go back and go back to our jobs, let's go back fishing and forget it." It said they departed from the presence of the council rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. Amazing. Worthy to suffer shame. Ever felt that way? Someone comes upon you and criticizes you or attacks you for your beliefs. You should feel worthy that you were found in that situation, able to suffer shame for his name. I believe there's a reward involved. Once you do that, Yahshua said in Matthew chapter 15, verse 13, I'd like to go there. 15, verse 13, he answered, well, let's back up. Then came his disciples, verse 12, and said unto him, Know you that the Pharisees were offended after they heard this saying? And he answered and said, Every plant which my heavenly Father has not planted shall be rooted up. Let them alone. They be blind leaders of the blind. And if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. Both will fall into the ditch if they're not guided. So how can we detect a wolf in sheep's clothing? How do we know? Yahshua said it's not that difficult. He said, look at his fruits. Both his life and the fruits of his labors. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. You see, because the messenger and the message come as a package deal, you can look at both. Most of the time, people don't look at both. I don't know why, but they don't. They don't look at the man. They just agonize over the message. And is he right? And I don't know about this. And oh man, I'm really confused now. If it doesn't get past examination of the man, you shouldn't even have to worry about it. Let's look at Matthew 7:15. Here we find Yahshua again saying, Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. You shall know them by their fruits. Fruits, what they produce. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree brings forth good fruit. That's its hallmark. A good tree will produce, and it'll produce what's good. But a corrupt tree brings forth evil fruit. If there's something innately wrong with this tree, if it's got some kind of poison or whatever, the fruit is going to be damaged, isn't it? A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that brings not good fruit is cast down, hewn down, and cast into the fire. He says in verse 20, Wherefore by their fruits you shall know them. And he gives us an example, verse 21. Not everyone says unto me, Master, Master, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that does the will of my Father. That's a fruit, to do Yahweh's will, to follow his commands. Many will say to me in that day, Master, Master, have we not prophesied in your name? Apparently some renegades running around thinking that they had his blessing. We prophesied in your name. We understood the name and we taught it and all that. And in your name, we've even cast out devils. And in your name, done many wonderful works. Well, certainly, these people have, you know, the approval. And then I will profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me. Why? You that work lawlessness, a type of bad fruit. Not good fruit, but lawlessness, a bad fruit. So what fruit should we be looking for? Does the wannabe meet the requirements to be a spokesman for Yahweh? All you got to do is turn to 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 and read it and compare. It's not really too difficult. 1 Timothy 3 is the qualifications for one who'd want to have a ministry. He says, this is the true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop, and really bishop and elder are the same thing, they come from the same basic Greek word in other places. He says, if he desires it, it's a good work. There's nothing wrong with that. But what about his motives? Is it purely selfish? A bishop must be blameless, he says, blameless. The husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality. Apt to teach, wanting to teach, desiring that. Not given to wine, not a drunkard, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient. Patient. It takes a lot of patience. Believe me, it takes a lot of patience. You're dealing with all sorts of different types of individuals from different backgrounds who have, you know, firmly implanted their mind. They understand what the Bible says, and sometimes they have to be led and guided a different direction. It takes patience. Sometimes it takes time. We had somebody at the feast after the Bible study. Says, you know, I'm really pretty new at this, but it's starting to make sense to me now. Starting to get through. Hallelujah, that was great to hear. Somebody brand new. Didn't understand. But now was starting to see some light. Not a brawler. If you don't agree with me, let's go outside and settle it man to man. You know, what's good is that going to do? People have that tendency sometimes when they get, you know, at their limit. But it takes a special amount of Yahweh's Spirit to keep you contained and still on track. Not covetousness. Not covetous. Not wanting things. Can't have a personal agenda, something that you want to strive for individually to do. I think I'm convinced that for some it's their call to glory, you know. Shouldn't be that. Should be a call to serve. One that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the assembly? I mean, you know, if his children don't listen, or if his wife is not of the faith, how can that work? I mean, he ought to start there first, shouldn't he? Instead of trying to go out and convince others, he needs to start at his own house. Not a novice. Not somebody brand new. Just came onto it. Oh, boy, he's all on fire. You know, I want to be a part of it. Well, you got some things to learn first. You got to go through some fire. Lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. See, it's not an ego thing. Moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into the reproach and the snare of the devil. What does that mean? What do his neighbors think about him? What do his friends think about him? They see him every day, maybe, or a lot more often. What do they think? If they think he's a rotten apple, he's got a problem. If they see right through him, he's a hypocrite, he's got a problem. So you can use all these tests. He says, moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, lest he fall into the reproach and snare of the devil. What is that teaching people outside to say, oh, I belong to this assembly? Really? And you do these things in your personal life. What is that teaching them? Oh, I want nothing part of that assembly. That's the snare of the devil. And then he goes on with deacons. They must be grave, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy of filthy lucre. The same basic qualifications. The only thing it doesn't say here is apt to teach. They're even more of a server than the servant, basically, because they do the real, you know, strenuous work. But they're also a guide. They're also there as an officer of the assembly. And let these first be proved, let them use the office of a deacon, being found blameless. Even so must their wives be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things. Test, test, test. Look at the qualifications. Look at the man. Is he worthy of what he's trying to convince me of? Is he worthy of being a leader in this doctrine he's trying to project? Let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their house as well, same thing. For they that have used the office of a deacon well, purchase to themselves a good degree and great boldness in the faith which is in Yahshua the Messiah. They should know that they have a good thing going. They have rewards waiting if they continue in the right way. There are tests that need to be looked at. And a guy that just comes in and, you know, just seeking a following, no matter, you know, what he's doing in his personal life, is to be very suspect if he doesn't measure up. Titus 1, I guess, basically is pretty much the same thing. I don't have time to go into that at this time, but if you want to look at that, it's the other passage that gives the qualifications of a leader. So you don't even need really to put his teachings to the test if he already fails in his personal life. That's as far as you need to go. End of story. You see, if neither he nor his family conforms to the scriptures, then he, by scriptural definition, is a hypocrite and a charlatan, presuming to expect you to believe and follow what he says. Let's turn to, I just want to look at one verse in Titus chapter 1, and verse 16. If a test of anyone who claims to be of Yahweh is given us here, it says they profess that they know Elohim, Titus 1:16. But in works, they deny him, being abominable and disobedient and unto every good work, reprobate. Reprobate. You know, nobody knows you better than your own children, do they? They live with you day in, day out. They know all the secrets. They know all the things that go on. Good test of a man is to look at his children. And are they in the faith if they're of age? If not, it demonstrates that he can't even do much with them, let alone someone else. Granted, they might have come into the faith, you know, after his children were grown, and that's a different story. But you should still see him continuing trying to reach them regardless. A man's own life can work against him if he's trying to fulfill a ministry. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. It shows how important our actions are. Our actions, you know, speak much louder than words. You tell a child to do something, and the child will do what you do, not necessarily what you tell him to do. You've heard children say things like, well, my dad does it, trying to justify some bad behavior. My dad does it. It's not, my dad says not to do it. My dad does it, so I'm going to do it. We speak far greater through our actions than our words. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. And here, Paul shows how important actions are. Verse 3, giving no offense in anything. Why? So that the ministry be not blamed. You see, as part of a ministry, you're also a part of what the assembly is all about. I mean, the assembly should follow the teachings. And if you can't do it, what kind of ministry have you got? But in all things, approving ourselves as the ministers of Elohim. In all things, in much patience. And it takes, again, it takes patience in afflictions. When there are problems, trials, how do we react? In necessities. When there's a need, is there cooperation? Are the cells all working together? Excuse me. In distresses. When things are really tough, what happens? Do you blow up? Do you react in a bad way? In labors, everything you do to the benefit and to the glory of Yahweh. In watchings, in fastings, these things should all be done. By pureness, by knowledge, by long suffering, it all comes together, it all goes together. By kindness, by the Spirit, by love that's not fake, unfeigned, genuine love. By the word of truth. Is the truth the main thing, or is it some other goal? By the power of Elohim, by the armor of righteousness. Boy, he just says a mouthful here. On the right hand and on the left. I mean, this man ought to know. He was starting assemblies all over Macedonia, Greece, Rome, working, seeing the reactions of people, seeing how it works, how it doesn't work. This man knows. He's been through the fire, and he knows exactly the pitfalls and the strengths. Kind of like to follow him around. I don't know if I could even keep up with this man and all that he did. Shipwrecks, in prison. What do you do in prison? Just sit and cry about it? No, he wrote letters. Wrote. Continuing on. No matter what he's doing. imagine upside down in a well hanging there. He'd probably still be doing some kind of ministry, yelling at them, telling them the truth or something. He never gave up. Constant work. Work, work, work. We think we have work. But honor and dishonor by evil report and the good report. Watch. Be careful. There's also an evil report that could come out if you're not doing the work properly. Good report. As deceivers, and yet true. True. They might call you a deceiver, and yet it's true. What you're saying is biblical. That's all part of it. As unknown and yet well known. Your reputation precedes you. Oh yeah, I know about you. You're that person. Fill in the blank. Your reputation is very important. Unknown and yet are known. As dying. And behold, we live as chastened and not killed. Known. Yet regarded as unknown. As sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. And that is difficult. You know, when we're down and out, it's hard to rejoice, isn't it? Go around with a long face. Man, woe is me. That's hard. I mean, you're looking at spiritual success, basically, here. If we can accomplish all of these things, this is what it's all about. And it's tough, because we human beings have things that war against that all the time. Our natures is the biggest one of them. And yet, that's what it takes. Looking on the good side always. Rejoicing as poor, yet making many rich. Don't have much in this life, but what things that really matter are the things that really count. Spiritual success. As having nothing, yet possessing all things. Oh, you Corinthians, our mouth is open unto you. Our hearts are enlarged. You are not straitened in us, but you are straitened in your own bowels. Now for recompense in the same, I speak as unto my children, be ye also enlarged. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness, he says. Why do you fellowship with those that believe differently, that you've proved is wrong? And what communion has light with darkness? And what concord has Messiah with Belial? Another word for Satan. Or what part has he that believes with an infidel? You know, there's just that unnatural, what would you call it? Something that kind of like a magnet, you know, with both ends repelling. That's how you feel sometimes when you get around an infidel. You just want to get away. There's nothing in common. There's no harmony there. And what agreement has the temple of Elohim with idols? Can't do it. For you are the temple of the living Elohim, as Elohim has said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their Elohim, and they shall be my people. Come out and be separate, he says. Touch not the unclean thing. And I will receive you and will be a father unto you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says Yahweh Almighty. What a passage. Very, very profound and very revealing in what it tells us. Shows us how important our actions are. After all, we should reflect what we're trying to teach, shouldn't we? I should hope so. And then, of course, we need to examine not only a person's life, but what they are trying to teach. And does it square with the scriptures? And that's the main thing. Does it square with the scriptures? You know, somebody once said, you know, I really think that there's a whole lot more in the Bible than what we have. You know, and people go off into apocryphas and stuff. I've never seen anything in the apocrypha that, you know, really enlightens me as to salvation any more than what I have here in the Word. You know, you can read the apocrypha if you want to. But what further light does it shed on salvation? I don't see it. In fact, it says, you know, if all of Yahshua's works were put in a book, the whole world couldn't contain it. He gives us enough. He gives us enough right here. That's all we need. The basics are all here. And that's what we need to go by. Go by the basics and prove, like the noble Bereans, whether these things are so. Go back into the Old Testament. Go into the New. Compare. Compare and see. If what's being taught contradicts what's in the Word, it can't be right. It simply can't be right. If it contradicts five other scriptures that say the opposite, then there's something wrong with that teaching. And don't latch on to it until you come to prove whether it's right or wrong. If it's right, certainly. If it's wrong, reject it, drop it. The doctrines or the teachings of anyone are priority number one, of course. I mean, that's what it's all about. This is why we're here. We're trying to learn what the book says and then apply it to our lives. But how we live our daily life is representative of whether we are of Yahweh or not. And each of us can look at that and say, am I living that life that Yahweh expects? Am I? Or am I being a little bit hypocritical? Saying one thing, telling people one thing, but in private doing something else. We're all representatives of Yahweh. We all are. When we're out in that world, we're you know, reflecting what He is teaching. And we should be, anyway. And it's all part of being of the true body of Messiah. That's what it's all about. It's another facet that we have to consider. And not just what we believe, but what do we practice. And it's a key indicator of how effective Yahweh is being in our life. Are changes happening? Or are we stagnating? Are we going nowhere? Are we just going through the motions, or are we really, truly believing what we're and following what we're told and understand to be truth? I hope this has helped in some ways, and I hope that we'll all be a little more aware of the wiles of the adversary, because it's going to get worse. We're going to see more and more. And it seems the attacks don't come until an assembly, a fledgling assembly, starts to grow and prosper. And then there's something there that somebody can grab if they can, and they'll try. So let's all be on guard and be careful. And may Yahweh bless you.